we had our lady come in who lost everything. Her husband woke up to the fire being on her house.
The Card Street fire consumes 10 structures near Sterling. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, June 16th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, Don Young argues against a relief well requirement to prevent a blowout in offshore Arctic drilling.
Sir, we would agree that the risk is low.
Real low.
We do agree that the risk is low.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating jobs and business opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. Many Alaskans who die in boating accidents don't die of hypothermia. Without a life jacket, drowning kills long before hypothermia does. More at pledgetolive.org. This message sponsored by Alaska Office of Boating Safety.
The Sockeye Fire burning north of Willow is now the number one priority fire in the country. KSKA's Ellen Lockyer is at the Houston High School, where fire managers have set up a command post. Hello, Ellen.
Hi, Gloria. I'm here.
Ellen, what's known about the current size of the fire?
Well, Incident Commander Tom Kurtz did say about 3 this afternoon that it had grown by 1,000 acres since yesterday. It's now officially 7,500 acres.
And are new crews arriving to help out?
Yes, the 5 new hotshot crews sent for yesterday have arrived. That would be about 100 men, 20 men per crew, and they're being put right to work. Because, as Kurt said, the original fire crews are facing fatigue. I mean, you don't know how hot it is up here. It's got to be 95 degrees.
What are they prioritizing in their work today?
Well, Kurt is prioritizing protecting structures, protecting the Alaska Railroad, and protecting the Parks Highway. Those are the priorities with the emphasis on protecting structures.
And were they able to tell you about structure loss, what the numbers are?
Well, the estimate now is loose. He said it was about between 50 and 100 structures, with the caveat that a structure is anything larger than 40 square feet. So we're talking about tool sheds. We're talking about even outhouses, greenhouses. They are not necessarily all homes. But they were being very cautious about not giving a hard number on homes lost because they really don't know yet.
All right. Thank you, Ellen, for that update.
Okay. Bye, Lori.
That was KSKA's Ellen Lockyer reporting live from the Incident Command Center at the Houston High School. The Card Street fire in Sterling on the Kenai Peninsula continued into its second day today. The fire has burned more than 1,500 acres. Hotshot crews are scheduled to be on the scene tonight. KDLL's Shaylin Cochran has more.
We had to leave again. It's kicked up again.
They just asked the
community. There's flames above the trees.
Okay.
They won't let you back in.
The community center in Sterling continues to be the hub for relief efforts. Residents are sharing updates along with food, clothes, phone chargers, pretty much everything. I was just opening my laptop to pull up the latest evacuation maps when a man who had just left the fire zone came over.
My name is Shun Adachi. I thought maybe my house going to burn down because it's very strong, very quickly to coming to the fielding lane and the Kenai Keys area. Then people were screaming, crying. Then it's a very horrible situation.
And so do you know if your house is...
My house is okay because our subdivision, all subdivision area is okay. But I'm feeling very sorry for people who lost their house.
Shun is one of the lucky ones. Crews have been battling the fire in his neighborhood for nearly 24 hours, and 10 structures have been destroyed. Krista Schooley is volunteering at the community center. She's already heard of some bad news for one family.
You know, we had a lady come in who lost everything, and, you know, she was able to save her 2 dogs. And, I mean, her husband woke up to the fire being on her house. And all he could do was grab the animals, the two dogs, and get out.
This fire has been confirmed as human-caused. It started Monday afternoon and quickly grew to more than 600 acres. Calm winds throughout the night and into Tuesday morning helped slow the fire's growth, but forestry spokesperson Terry Anderson says firefighters are concerned about the night's forecast.
The thing that concerns us today is a lightning forecast for the Kenai Peninsula. You might see some large clouds building up. That can cause erratic winds and thunderstorms late in the evening. That's the forecast for our area today.
A hotshot crew was scheduled to arrive on the scene Tuesday night, and a Type 2 management team is slated to take over operations Wednesday morning. Another forestry spokesperson, Andy Alexandru, says more air support will be on the way as well.
A couple of Blackhawks that were ordered up this morning from the National Guard to pitch in with their bucket and water capability, as well as a Canadian CL-215 scoop aircraft. We've seen them here in the state in the past.
Travelers along the Sterling Highway should check with the Department of Transportation's 511 number for information on closures. The Alaska State Troopers are in the area helping direct traffic as crews focus their attention on the east end of the fire, where it's just a couple miles from the highway. Reporting from Sterling, I'm Shaylin Cochran.
A lightning-caused wildfire in the interior is burning near the village of Dot Lake. The Tanana Slough Fire has burned about 500 acres on an island in the Tanana River. The island is about 3 miles north of the small native community off the Alaska Highway near Tok. Area State Forester Jeff Hermans says suppression efforts are aimed at keeping the fire on the island.
Not let it escape out of the slough where there's unburned, there's lots of fuels in front of it for miles in either direction. And so far we've been successful in that. It's tried spotting out a couple of times and we're able to keep the fire in check.
Herman says firefighters hope to conduct a burnout operation to consume fuels on the island when winds are favorable. Meanwhile, another wildfire is burning in the Yukon Flats near Fort Yukon. The Back Yukon Slough blaze has burned about 40 acres as of last night. The human-caused fire was about 20 miles northwest of the village. The Alaska Interagency Coordination Center reports that 14 smoke jumpers are working the blaze. Alaska's film tax credit program has gone from comatose to dead. Governor Bill Walker signed a bill ending the subsidies on Monday. The program was created in 2008, and it's paid about $50 million in credits to television shows, movies, and documentaries filmed in the state. The program was already scheduled to sunset in 2018, but Walker repealed the program because he does not expect oil prices and state revenue to bounce back by then. In a statement, Walker said he supported the film industry, but the credits were not justifiable when the state is in deficit spending mode. Supporters of the program argued that it brought jobs and economic activity to communities used as filming locations. The program has granted credits to television shows like The Deadliest Catch and Sarah Palin's Alaska, and to movies like Frozen Ground. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a quick response saved hundreds of dogs from the Sockeye Fire.
And I got home from work and my dog yard was completely packed up in other people's dog trucks that had gone there to help.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, an Alaskan company providing lifting and rigging products since 1983, on the web at arcticwirerope.com. And by Raven Alaska, providing business travel needs in over 100 communities across the state. Find more at flyraven.com.
A bill by U.S. Senator Lisa Murkowski cleared an appropriations subcommittee this afternoon, but controversy is brewing over sections that would undo two of the Obama administration's highest-profile environmental efforts. The bill would also compel a land exchange to build an 11-mile road in the Eisenbeck National Wildlife Refuge to connect King Cove and Cold Bay. If the state of Alaska agrees to the land exchange, the bill would require the federal government to trade some 200 acres in the refuge so the road can be built, according to Murkowski's staff. Murkowski has long argued the road is necessary for medical evacuations, and she says this bill aims to pin down the feds.
We're not going to let the Interior Department say they're not interested. We've already gone down that road once before.
Nationally, the bill would block new rules defining waters of the U.S. in the Clean Water Act. Republicans complain the so-called WOTUS rule is EPA overreach. The bill would also gut new Obama administration limits on greenhouse gas emissions from power plants. Murkowski, as chairman of an appropriations subcommittee, is responsible for writing the bill that funds Interior, the EPA, and other resource agencies. She says the bill fully funds contract support costs for Native-run hospitals. It also changes the way fighting wildfires is funded, so agencies won't have to divert money from other programs to pay for major fires. The top Democrat on the subcommittee, Tom Udall of New Mexico, says he has deep objections to the policy changes.
This bill takes dead aim at core environmental laws that have for decades protected the health of our communities, our families, and our environment. And for decades, we're bipartisan.
Udall says he'll try to strip those sections out on Thursday when the bill goes to the full committee. The safety of drilling in the Arctic Ocean was debated at a congressional hearing this morning. Advocates of oil and gas development say the rules the government wants to impose on future offshore projects in the Arctic are too burdensome. APRN's Liz Ruskin reports.
If Shell goes ahead with plans to drill in the Chukchi Sea this summer, it will be following custom-crafted safety terms it worked out with the federal government. The government now wants to lock some of those requirements into regulations to apply to future Arctic projects. It was obvious at the hearing that industry especially dislikes one proposed condition, the requirement that an operator be able to drill a same-season relief well in case of a blowout. Alaska Congressman Don Young says Arctic wells are unlikely to go out of control because they would tap shallow, low-pressure petroleum reservoirs. Young challenged Brian Salerno, head of the Bureau of Safety and Environmental Enforcement, on whether a blowout is even possible there.
Sir, we would agree that the risk is low.
Real low.
We do agree that the risk is low. But
and I hear that term blowout from two of the witnesses here. That's what I call leading in hysteria. This is a chance of the blowout will not occur. The chances will not occur because they are low pressure.
Should something occur and you do not have the means to deal with it, you may be stuck with an out-of-control well till the next season.
The same-season relief well requirement means operators would have to send two rigs to the Arctic, so it's expensive. It also shrinks the drilling season because they'd have to stop regular operations with enough time left to drill an emergency well before the ice returns in the fall. Drew Pierce, a former Alaska legislator and now a policy advisor to industry, says the requirement actually increases risk. As Pierce sees it, the shorter season means it will take 2 years to drill a single well, and each year an armada of support vessels has to sail from Dutch Harbor into the Arctic and back.
And most of the accidents that put oil in the water are transportation-related accidents. So you have at least doubled, if not more than doubled, the risk by forcing that transportation twice.
Pierce says new safety technologies used in other countries would be more effective than a relief well in the unlikely event of a blowout. For Congresswoman Lois Capps, a California Democrat whose district includes Santa Barbara, the reassurances rang hollow.
The company that operates the oil pipeline that recently burst in my district also assured state regulators that pipeline was, quote, state-of-the-art, and that spills were extremely unlikely. On May 19th, that extremely unlikely event actually happened.
Now, the Congresswoman says, 100 miles of California beaches are fouled by heavy offshore crude, fishermen are suffering, and hundreds of birds are dead. Pierce, though, says that pipeline accident in Santa Barbara proves one of her points, that most oil spills stem from transportation, not drilling. In Washington, I'm Liz Ruskin.
A giant drill rig operated by Royal Dutch Shell undocked yesterday morning from Terminal 5 in Seattle. As KUCB's Emily Schwing reports, the Transocean Polar Pioneer is headed for Dutch Harbor, where it will dock until the company is ready to head to the Bering and Chukchi Seas to explore for oil later this summer.
The trip from Seattle to Dutch Harbor is expected to take 12 days. In an email, Shell spokeswoman Megan Baldino wrote that the oil giant, quote, remains committed to operating in a safe, environmentally responsible manner, unquote, and that the company looks forward to exploring its Chukchi leases in the weeks ahead. According to the Coast Guard, 24 arrests were made as tugboats moved the Polar Pioneer out of port. A group of so-called kayaktivists formed a blockade in an attempt to stop the rig from departing Seattle, where it's been docked for the last month. As the Polar Pioneer pulled out of Seattle, officials from the city of Onalaska met with Shell's marine operations team. According to Mayor Shirley Marquardt, staff from the Department of Ports and Harbors, as well as marine pilots, members of the Onalaska Police Department, and the city manager were in attendance. Shell representatives have said they're trying to be transparent about their plans this summer. Mayor Marquardt says the company's been proactive about working with the local community.
No question. And certainly it has been with, again, this work group, the wind of the people that they really needed to, who really need to know how they're going to operate, which is the port and the pilots and the Coast Guard, you know, and the police and, you know, the city structure.
25 support vessels are expected to arrive in Dutch Harbor in the next 2 weeks, along with supplies and personnel. Monday's meeting was the third Shell has hosted to brief local officials on their plans. In Onalaska, I'm Emily Schwing.
Fishing communities across Bristol Bay are pulsing with action these days as armies of fishermen work to ready their vessels for the extra-large return of salmon this year. KDLG's Matt Martin spent the weekend at the boatyard in Naknek and has this story.
Still sitting on stilts in the boatyard, the Homeward rumbles to life for the first time this season. The Lummi Yard is a beehive of activity, with people making all the final preparations before they put their boats in the water. Carl Spielman is the skipper of the Vantage Point. He's hoping to get his boat started up and in the water in a day or two.
And get the boat up and running, sort of wake it up, like a bear coming out of hibernation.
The same thing could be said about the town of Naknek itself. There is traffic on the roads, and there's an energy in the air as people are anxious for the start of the season. Spielman looks forward to that feeling each year. He's been fishing out of Naknek for almost four decades.
Like deer camp, when you go out hunting or something, we come up in the spring and see each other for the first time, and we share tools, and it's really fun.
The nonstop roll of customers in Lummi's marine shop had the store owners too busy to even sit down for a short interview. But Sam Yoder, who fishes on the FV Thumper, was at the store looking for some parts.
I'm trying to plumb in a refrigeration system, but unfortunately, kind of slim pickings for parts this time of year when everybody's trying to do the same thing. So, you know, it's a bit of a struggle. You got to get a little creative when it comes to putting things together.
Even though he was a little stressed about finding the right piece he needed, the prospect of a large return and the warm, sunny weather had him ready to fish. And the slogan on his tank top was a clear sign of that.
That's it, man. Sun's out, guns out. You know it.
Yoder has been fishing for 20 years, and he wouldn't think of doing anything else.
You know, honestly, I don't know what I'd do if I had a summer off. I hear the 4th of July is fun, but I wouldn't know.
All the fishermen in town seem to have one goal in mind, to get their boats in the water. One boat even had a robotic fish singing the crew's theme song for the week. In Naknek, I'm Matt Martin.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by First National Bank Alaska, where local knowledge and experience make the difference. We believe in Alaska. Learn more at fnbalaska.com. Equal housing lender, member FDIC. If you're ready to quit tobacco, Alaska's Tobacco Quit Line can help with free confidential coaching and support services through the telephone and online. Now introducing Text to Quit, a way to help you use medications correctly, manage urges, and prevent relapse all from your mobile phone. Call 1-800-QUIT now or visit alaskaquitline.com for more information. This message sponsored by Alaska's Tobacco Prevention and Control Program.
Dozens of people have been evacuated from properties in the vicinity of the Card Street fire near Sterling. Larissa Nodder and her husband Jason left their home yesterday evening with as much as they could pack into their cars. KPBI's Shady Grove Oliver reports.
Yesterday was a moment of terrible deja vu for Larissa and Jason Nodder. A little more than a year ago, they got the same call to evacuate their Salmon Run Drive home during the Funny River fire. She says this year, the second time around, it's a bit easier.
Yeah, it was. And last year I was quite hysterical. This year it's quite a lot calmer.
She found out about the fire first from a coworker. Then she called the Office of Emergency Management. Then she got the call from Rapid Notify. But despite getting some advance notice, by the time she got home, she could clearly see the smoke building just 2.5 miles from her house.
So we're like, okay, we got to get out of there. So we didn't have time to get our chickens.
They didn't have enough space to transport all the chickens, and the wind wasn't blowing the fire toward the house. So they made sure they had food and water, but had to leave them behind. She and her husband packed up as much as they could fit into the cars. Clothes, camping gear, inflatable mattress, the cats, the dog, pet food, medicines, toiletries, important paperwork. Like many young couples, they have items borrowed from friends and family. She says they tried to grab as much of those as they could, too.
There were a couple things that we forgot. I forgot our wedding box, that's what I call it. And then we forgot the painting that his mom painted for us.
In retrospect, she says she wishes she'd made a better list after last year, and she will after this. They turned off the gas, threw a wool blanket over the propane tank, something an emergency worker recommended last year, and turned the sprinklers on. Then they threw the wood from their wood pile about 30 feet from the house. They took their guns and most of their ammo.
It also helps to leave a note. I don't know if they read it or not, but I left a note for whoever comes to check on our place with our contact information and they needed to get a hold of us.
It mentions the chickens and the fact that there may be some shotgun shells in the house. In case firefighters have to go inside, she wants them to be safe. And these are some of the things she's learned as a second-time evacuee, information you never thought you'd need to know so well. I asked if having to do this a second year in a row has made them reconsider where they live. Is it too prone to wildfires, or is it just bad luck?
We are a little bit concerned, but I kind of have a rule. Twice it's a coincidence, third time it's not, so... if we have to evacuate for a third time, we're probably going to rethink things.
Her area is no longer under a mandatory evacuation, but it's still just 2 miles from the fire. Nodder says they're playing it by ear. They hope to go back to check on the chickens and pull a few more things out of the house just in case, and then wait again to see what happens next. In Homer, I'm Shady Grove Oliver.
As the Sockeye fire continues to burn near Willow, people are waiting to assess the toll on life and property. Hundreds of animals were evacuated to other areas in the valley. As KSKA's Zachariah Hughes reports, the sled dog response was part of their emergency management plan.
But yeah, we can sit in the cab if you don't mind getting your town clothes covered in dog hair.
Iditarod veteran Lisbeth Norris greets me with a beer in her hand, feet covered in dust. Norris had just scarfed down a hamburger and was finally getting a chance to breathe after a day and a half of scrambling out of the fire's path. She evacuated her kennel on Sunday afternoon.
In the event that we lost everything, I wanted to make sure that I would be able to continue to train the dogs. So I loaded up my sleds and my harnesses and my gear.
Members of Willow's tight-knit mushing community mobilized fast and got hundreds of animals to safety at different sites in the valley, including the fenced-in lot behind Underdog Feeds in Wasilla, which Norris's family runs. Just a few weeks ago, Willow mushers had reassessed their emergency evacuation plans.
Actually, it was in our last Willow Dog Mushers meeting.
Jamie West is the group's secretary.
It was recognized that because of the little amount of snow that we had, it would be a bad fire season. And it was pretty right on.
West sits on a cot inside a tent flanked by two tractor trailers, shading a string of dogs, along with several other animals hitched wherever there's space. Her husband hauls jugs of water from a spigot in the feed store to keep the animals cool, with temperatures still hovering in the 80s. West says the herd of pets has shrunk since they first evacuated from their home by milepost 65.
It's like the Noah's Ark. We had two baby goats, and we had our own chickens, and we have our own horses. And then we had 15 of someone else's sled dogs.
The borough requires kennels to have an emergency plan in place, but mushers camped out in trucks and under blue tarps donated by Home Depot say it was phone calls and Facebooking with neighbors that sprang everybody into action as the blaze erupted Sunday. Sitting in the cab of the truck where she'll spend the night, Jenny Evans says that while she herself wasn't prepared for the evacuation, her neighbors were.
And I got home from work and my dog yard was completely packed up in other people's dog trucks that had gone there to help.
Though there have been some scattered reports of pets dying in the blaze, the borough's animal care manager says they haven't received any news of injured or loose animals at the Matsu shelter in the days since the fire intensified. Property damage is harder to pin down. By Monday morning, many in the underdog lot believed their homes were lost, only to hear afterwards that the fire had spared their property. A disaster declaration by FEMA cites 25 homes burned. That figure helps free up resources to fight the fire, but as Jeremy Zedek with the state's Office of Emergency Management says, getting hard numbers won't be possible until locals on the ground can see which houses and outbuildings have been destroyed.
While the fire is still raging, it's very difficult to get any type of accurate damage assessment. So the numbers that we have now are preliminary.
With a sleeping mat rolled out next to her truck and across from two dozen huskies clipped to a fence, Lisbeth Norris is mostly concerned with getting her team fed and rested. In the yard, they're safe and comfy enough. For Norris, the hardest part is behind her, making the difficult decisions about what else she'd be able to carry out from her family's compound.
And then I went inside and asked Grandma what she would like us to take. And what do you salvage from, like, 94 years of life?
In this case, it was a 60-pound tote filled with precious books, some photos, along with a single trophy commemorating her grandmother's prize-winning dog, Bonzo.
Just nice to hold on to.
Norris isn't sure when she'll get to go home, but for now, she has most of what she needs. Reporting in Wasilla, I'm Zachariah Hughes.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. We're online at alaskapublic.org. And we had reports tonight from Ellen Lockyer in Houston, Zachariah Hughes in Wasilla, Shailen Cochran in Kenai, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Emily Schwing in Unalaska, Matt Martin in Dillingham, and Shady Grove Oliver in Sterling. APRN's Alexandra Gutierrez reported from Juneau and Liz Ruskin from Washington, D.C. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Spinard Builder Supply. For more than 60 years, SBS has helped Alaskans build from ground to roof to everything in between. Spinard Builder Supply is here to build with you.
And by
Doyon Limited, Interior Alaska's regional native corporation providing oilfield services, government contracting, and natural resource development in Alaska and across the nation. Information at doyon.com. The Older Persons Action Group is the publisher of the monthly Senior Voice newspaper and the 2015 Directory for Older Alaskans. To order the directory or learn more, go to SeniorVoiceAlaska.com. This message sponsored by OPAG. Alaska Pacific University offers an affordable education, small class sizes, and life-friendly schedules designed to support your personal and professional goals. APU is still accepting applications for fall 2015. Find out about financial aid and the promised tuition grant and apply online at alaskapacific.edu before Saturday, August 1st. This message sponsored by Alaska Pacific University.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.